Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Peter Bregan, and as most of you know by now, I am a psychiatrist. I first got involved with psychiatry way back as an 18-year-old, as I've talked about before, because it was so formative for me, working in state mental hospitals as a volunteer at Harvard. And one of the things I noticed about the state mental hospitals was that they were, to a great extent, repositories for the elderly whom no one else wanted. I don't know how aware I was of ageism way back then in 1954. I think not very. But it was clear to me that these were people who had nowhere else to go and no one to care for them, that they were often chronically ill, and that the idea of them being mentally ill was mainly a cover story for throwing them into the nation's wastebasket. Maybe others would have said it was the safety net, but it wasn't. It was the garbage can of the state mental hospitals. Now, of course, we pretty much phased out the great majority of mental hospitals. Those that exist are small. They no longer are 30,000-person villages, feudal estates like they were. And we've got many of them now in nursing homes where they are very, very heavily medicated. In the U.S., we've passed laws to try to, federal laws, to try to improve the care of people in nursing homes, to set standards. Hasn't worked terribly well. In Canada, I'm currently an expert witness in a pending class action suit. I've been approved as an expert, but the class action suit hasn't yet been certified. I hope it will. It's to stop the giving of antipsychotic drugs to the elderly. It's a huge issue. It reflects on our societies. How we treat our elderly reflects on us as to how we view it. And interestingly, at my age of 77, I'm well into what's considered elderly. But fortunately, in no way feeble or unable to take care of myself. But I have to say, I have a personal, more and more personal interest in the subject. My guest today is Dr. Peter Gordon, and he is from Scotland. Are you there, sir?
I am, yes, here, Peter.
Well, it's a miracle. It's a miracle. It's lovely to hear you. We've linked up. Let me tell you a little bit about this man. This man is really an interesting man, and I think a prince among physicians, although that will embarrass him. He says he's 45 years old. He's in the National Health Service in England, the NHS, where he works with older adults. He says he does it 3 days a week because he has other interests, and one of them is to make very interesting and compassionate video films. In describing himself, he mentions right away who he's married to, which is something I do all the time. And is her name pronounced Sian? Sian?
Yeah, she's a Welsh woman. It's Sian.
Sian.
Sian. Yeah, Sian.
Sian. S-I-A-N.
Yes. And, it's an unusual Welsh name.
I've not seen it before. It's a lovely name. They were both trained in medicine at Aberdeen University. Peter graduated in 1990. I'm going to let him tell you more about his websites and his sources of information, but the little list he sent me of what he's interested in is really a wonderful introduction. He says he's an evidence-based practitioner. That's the only part I don't like, because usually nowadays that means I follow the drug company protocols. And we can talk about that later. But he's concerned about reductionism, and he's concerned about the use of these cognitive scales as a primary rating factor, talking about the aging and memory loss. He's concerned about our not looking at this complex issue, but simplifying it. And he's concerned about the way we're marketing the idea of memory loss and treatment for it. I think he's concerned about the early diagnosis and screening. And he put in parentheses, he's concerned about Alzheimerism or Alzheimerization. Let's give you an idea of the subjects we can cover in an hour. He's concerned about the stigma of aging and of Alzheimer's. And one thing I liked, he's concerned about the military metaphors.
Yes.
The war on Alzheimer's, the war on the mentally ill, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's like me, he's very concerned about key opinion leaders and their relationships to the pharmaceutical industry, the joint working together. Mm-hmm. So welcome. Welcome, welcome to the show. I'm really looking forward to this.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Pick up wherever you would like.
Well, yeah, I just explain a little bit more of my background. I'm a consultant doctor in the NHS in Scotland, and we live just in the centre of Scotland, just below Stirling Castle, and I cover a community mental health team. But what I'll be speaking about today, just to be clear, will be my own thoughts and views, not those of the NHS organisation, because it's quite big. But I'm quite happy to share my own views with you and hopefully have a discussion together. I've always enjoyed working with the elderly, and I think I've always been acutely aware of the potential to treat people differently just because of their age. And that's something I'm not necessarily comfortable with. And I've got a nice quote here, because in the Western world, thankfully, we're all generally, going by demographics, we're living longer. And this quote by Thomas says that we're living in the most elder-rich period of human history, elder-rich, and it's upon us. And how we regard and make use of this windfall of elders will define the world we live in. And I think that this is very important. And I don't know about the States or beyond Great Britain, but my fear is with some of the policies that are well-intentioned as they are for our elderly, are actually they carry some ageism in them, in that they simplify the person. They don't start with the person. They may say they start with the person, but they start with a disease. And this goes back to the rating skills, and we can maybe talk a bit more about that. But that's a wee introduction to myself and roughly where I start. And my other main interest is I did an arts degree in Edinburgh University, so that's where my filmmaking comes in. And I started making home films and being interested in local history, but more and more these days they have a medical slant or a slightly philosophical slant, and increasingly they tend to be about subjects involving our older adults and some of the issues that I think may not be talked about. And I'm particularly concerned that the younger generation make decisions on behalf of our elders but don't consult them properly. And that's certainly happening in the UK. Does that help a wee bit?
I'd like to just have you keep talking. I think you have a lot to tell us. And, you know, the issue of Alzheimer's, the issue of the elderly. I like the concept that we're confusing, really, people with their, quote, diseases. Even when the disease is a genuine disorder, although we may not understand it, it's a genuine physical disorder, dementia, we shouldn't confuse that with the person.
No, we shouldn't. And dementia is a very real condition and can indeed be terrible and progressive and result in the need of care. And we do see more dementia around about us. But I think there is a problem, and the problem goes back to the understanding of what we hear Alzheimer's word every day. We open a newspaper, hear it in the news, and it's usually described in terms like burden. We need a war, as you were mentioning in your introduction, a war on Alzheimer's, a battle, it's a fight, it's a thief, it's a robber, it's even our Prime Minister in the British Isles, David Cameron, did a dementia challenge speech. And it was chock full of military metaphors, which I thought it was really not helpful because it adds to stigma. He said we need an all-out fight back against Alzheimer's. The trouble with this is that as we get older, despite hearing about Alzheimer's all the time, the actual pathological concept for it is very old and actually does not fit with the current evidence that we're finding. We've had 40 years of research looking at amyloid, and the drug companies have concluded now that it's not as simple as looking at a post-mortem brain, seeing amyloid or tau protein there, and concluding that somebody had Alzheimer's disease, because I could die right now, they slice open my brain, and we'd find Alzheimer's and tau protein. Equally, you could get somebody who died with severe dementia, and they look at their brain scan, as in the Nunn study that David Snowden did, and you can find very minimal, if any, pathology of Alzheimer's. So the pathological construct is a simplification, and science is beginning to prove that it's not quite as understood as you go from A to B and develop Alzheimer's disease, particularly in the group that are what they call the older elderly, you know, those in the late 70s, 80s, 90s, 100s. And I increasingly have a difficulty. I don't like the concept senile dementia either, don't get me wrong, but I would prefer just to use the concept of understanding what a clinical dementia is rather than just using Alzheimer's. And just to finish this wee bit of thread of thinking off, Professor Clive Ballard is probably one of the greatest professors, certainly in the UK, and he's director of research at the Alzheimer's Society, and he concluded just last year in The Lancet, which is a major journal, he said, the paradigmatic, that means the cardinal pathology, brain pathology of Alzheimer's disease, plaques and tangles, is only a post-mortem finding of limited explanatory value in the expression of dementia in the population. Now, this is just such a... We just have to stop and think about this. Am I talking too much?
No,
I'm
about this
just for 1 minute, because...
I have a question,
If this pathology is of limited explanatory value, it means that if we're looking for biological markers, it may not be as simple as that. And so the potential to look for early Alzheimer's disease may capture an awful lot of our older adults who maybe have mild memory impairment but will never develop dementia. And this is a subject that's not talked about, and it's not popular. The marketeers have remarketed, in my opinion, looking at some of the branding companies. Instead of talking about mild cognitive impairment, they're now talking about early Alzheimer's disease. And it's true, people who develop a more advanced dementia of an Alzheimer's type will have early symptoms. But it's equally true that many people who have early symptoms will never develop dementia. And these are the people that risk being false positively labeled as suffering from Alzheimer's. So that's a concern of mine, and it's a very difficult and complicated area. But I just believe it goes back to what you said at the beginning, Peter, taking a holistic approach, assessing somebody very carefully, using time to your advantage, talking about risk and understanding, living a good, healthy lifestyle, explaining what drugs can and can't do, not overhyping them, as I think many medicines like the cognitive enhancers like Aricept have been overhyped. They are not disease-modifying. They can make a small symptomatic difference to some people, and that's important and helpful. But ultimately, if you look at the evidence, they don't make a huge impact. So they shouldn't be the be-all and end-all of deciding somebody who's got memory loss. It's more about understanding the person and what cognitive losses they have. And also, I'll just finish and let you speak. The final bit is the rating scales. A lot of the rating scales, we've got to be very, I think it was Stephen Post talked about a hyper-cognitive society, and that's a society that rates individuals by their short-term memory. Now, this is fraught with difficulty, because if you do this, we're still not in 2013 in a clinically sound enough world to be absolutely sure what we're describing in this sense. And I think we should be seeing people as the people they are. Yes, do rating skills, they might be important, but don't start with the rating skills. So if we start doing screening, the potential for harm really is quite significant.
Well, that's a lot, and it's all very, very important. Let me ask a couple of just specific questions. Yep. Are you thinking that the Alzheimer's is not actually a specific clinical syndrome because what we used to use as the markers really aren't reliable markers, so we should be thinking more generally that there is some complex of disorders that result in dementia, but maybe Alzheimer's per se is not a specific syndrome?
Yeah, I think particularly in the group of 70 years old and above, when Alzheimer's first described his patient in 1907, he didn't give the name Alzheimer's. It was colleague Craplin, and it was a lady called Auguste, and it was an early onset dementia. And I think the Alzheimer's concept as a pure disease is probably far more robust in that early onset group. I think the further we travel through life, it's less robust. And there's so many contributing factors that we know from science that can lead to what's called Alzheimer's disease. So you could have not having had the opportunity for education in youth, head injuries, diet disturbance, exposure to toxic chemicals, alcohol. You know, there's a whole host of life course events that lead up to multiple different pathways, I think, and many other researchers are concluding, are behind what ultimately may result in dementia. And we're not entirely convinced. I think we're keeping an open mind, but we're not entirely convinced it can be entirely explained back to this sort of reductionist concept. Actually, it's more than 100 years old, of the plaques and tangles in the brain. It's looking unlike, they may be byproducts of lifetime damage, but in themselves, they're not, they don't outline a specific disease. As you said, it might be better to be calling this a dementia syndrome. And looking, and because I think the simplified pathways, we've spent billions and billions, and it's been good research because it's proved that it's not as simple as just resulting, Alzheimer's resulting from amyloid pathology in particular. Some people are still arguing there's the potential for tau pathology, which is a different type of pathology. But equally, there's been at least 20 years of research in that, and that's still not looking promising either.
What is that second thing you said, Peter?
Pathophysiological pathways are quite complicated.
Can you say what is the second thing that you just described in addition to the amyloid? The what?
It's tau protein. There is some research going on looking at ways of preventing tau protein formation. There's one dye in particular called methylene blue that they've tried. It's a drug that's in trial, but some people as companies producing it would do, they think it's going to be the next cure, but I think we need to keep an open mind. I would bet that it's the pathways behind later onset dementia are far more complicated and are not going to be simply targeted by one drug affecting one protein buildup. I don't know if that helps. We're still in an area of working this through, and we need science, and we need to continue to do research. But I think at this moment in time, we need to be very careful about defining some of our elders as suffering from Alzheimer's disease when they may have mild memory problem that will never progress. And we do know the statistics in this group because Big Pharma have done huge amounts of studies, for example, with Aricept and the other drugs, Exelon and Rivastigmine, to see if their medications would prevent progression from mild cognitive impairment, or whatever we call it, mild memory loss in older age, to dementia. And they found absolutely conclusive. You can guarantee that they found this, and I know because I've looked at the studies, that it made no difference whatsoever. Because if it had made a difference, these drugs would be marketed to everybody. As soon as we're all over 50, we would be getting them. So, but there are some exciting things going, I think, in the Alzheimer's and dementia field. And they're, mostly at the moment, they're about lifestyle issues, making sure you're having as healthy a life as you can do, being fit, active, looking after your cardiovascular health, etc. You know, all the usual routine messages, which are still so very important.
Do you think that actually exercising your brain does help prevent dementia? And if so, how? Is it by just developing multiple synapses and alternative pathways, or what?
The honest answer to that is I genuinely don't know. I certainly think it, and it's not an area where my research is not, I've more covered the pathological side. But I don't think it does any harm whatsoever to be, you know, to keeping one's cerebration as active as possible. Whether actual what we call brain exercises help prevent decline, I don't know. But what we do know, there is a very good book called Aging with Grace, and it's by David Snowden, and it's about, it looked at a group of nuns over a long period of time. And to cut a long story short, the nuns were a very kind and beautiful group and got to know David Snowden, the researcher, very well. And they permitted on death to allow autopsy and post-mortem of their brains. But the one there was many conclusions made from that study, but one of the one that I found most fascinating was that the nuns who had been educated and were and wrote, when they entered the nunnery, they all wrote a two-page account of their lives. And when they compared the complexity of the language and the outcome at the end of life, they found that those nuns who were educated and language rich were more likely not to develop dementia. And that seemed to be a significant finding. So that's very interesting. And there's certainly strong associations between one's education and intellectual background and whether you develop dementia or not. So it proves that this is not all about what's going on inside the brain. It's also about what's happened in your life in the real world, I guess, is the sort of message I'm trying to get across.
Do you know that research well enough? I mean, I hate to put you on the spot because I've heard about the research too, but do you think that, having more language ability in education would also correlate with an awful lot of other positive things in your childhood?
Yes.
Compared to people who didn't. I mean, the people who didn't have such good language probably came from poorer backgrounds and probably not as well nourished, I would guess.
I think you're probably right. I think you're right, Peter, and I'm sure a lot of those factors would be in there. So they were able to look at that in that level. But so there could be many different reasons for that. But it is nevertheless, it's very interesting, isn't it?
Yes, it's very, very, very interesting. Now, this is quite a bit off. And if it's out of your area, let me know. What about the relationship between sports and dementia? Is there a relationship between the level of injury that people get in high school sports, do you think, the head injury and dementia later on?
There certainly is risk. I couldn't quantify the risk for you. I mean, for a long time they've talked about dementia pugilistica, which is a dementia you've probably heard of associated with boxing.
I used to call it punch drunk.
Yes, that's right. And these days, I know in Scotland we're quite keen rugby supporters, and they are more and more aware that there is risk with repeated head injuries, I think. But I don't know. I must be honest, I don't know specific studies or haven't looked at that in any depth.
Are there efforts being made in England in Scotland, Great Britain, to develop places for people who are suffering from dementia to have optimal care? We've talked a lot about it in this country. I don't think there's a lot of places that provide the care, stimulation, love, attention, which I think dementia patients need. They just need what everybody needs, but maybe more of it, not less,
absolutely,
which is what they're going to get.
It's the absolute key to this. It's about care, kindness, attention, and good environment. There is a lot of positive movements. There's not enough money around, of course, and resource. But there's a group called the Dementia Challengers, which are a group of carers who have had relatives with dementia, and they're really making a significant difference in bringing out all particularly the topic of well-being in dementia. And arguing what is important. So that's, of course, the obvious things that medicine must never lose sight of is the person. Start with the person. Don't start with the disease. So they're arguing that, and also talking in much more sophisticated ways, really, than perhaps some of the medical discourse about how we care for elders with memory loss, but don't in the same breath stigmatize them as somehow other or different, because that's my general fear, and I may be wrong in this, but my general fear is a lot of the discourse, particularly from politicians, well-meaning, but they don't really understand what dementia is, So it becomes, in their mind, a reduced concept of somebody who's different. And many people have very fixed ideas in their mind what it is to have dementia, or that horrible word, demented. And so I think these dementia challengers are enriching this discussion, talking about narrative behind people, talking about how lots of things can help, like dance and storytelling, reading groups, music, walking. I used to, there was a lovely man on our ward recently who had really, who had been a head teacher and had very advanced dementia, probably of an Alzheimer's type. And I used to go out for a walk with him. Now, he couldn't remember. We would have the same conversation many times. But in the few minutes that we were having that conversation, it would be a rich and detailed conversation. And I would ask him, what did he think about having this diagnosis? I would ask him about his past life and these sort of things. He would ask a bit about my life. And yes, we would repeat the conversation. But in the moment and in the time, I got as much from the walk as he did. And he wasn't that. His compassion, his interest in my family, his social cues were just the same as you or I. And my fear is that maybe some well-intending people who are making policy don't really see individuals like that. They see the dementia. They think of the dementia first. Of course, you can get cases of dementia which can be very severe and cause behavioural and psychiatric problems. And that is the case. But they are not the majority. They're certainly not the majority. I see some of those because it's in my job. But the majority of people with memory loss and dementia can live very happily at home. And the trouble is, as you were beginning to talk about at the start of the show, is that once you end up in nursing care, your autonomy goes, or it potentially goes. And decisions ever more quickly are made on your behalf. And this is where I worry, along with yourself, that there is the risk of over-medicalization, using medicines inappropriately. And this is a concern not just that you and I share, Peter. It's I don't know in America, but in a lot of the drives currently are to reduce the use of off-label antipsychotic medication in our elderly. But the reason we got here in the first place, and this is what gets me annoyed, is that our medical education, certainly in where I've been educated in Scotland and in the UK, has been largely orchestrated through the pharmaceutical industry, and it's quite hidden. And the key opinion leaders, I've got to be careful here what I say, but if you look at key opinion leaders generally across medicine, not in any particular group, at the moment we're beginning to see this in America because they've got this site called Dollars for Doc, and you can look at the key opinion leaders and what they've been paid from pharma, and you're talking about huge amounts of money. And I think if people actually were aware of this and thought about it and could look at their doctors, they might say, wait a minute, was that why these atypical antipsychotics were prescribed so heavily for our elderly? When we got these guidelines for behavioural and psychological disturbances and dementia, who produced those? Oh, it was the pharmaceutical industry. Wait a minute, maybe we should just be a bit more cautious about what we're doing here. So my view is, I do think that there is a small group of patients who do benefit from very small doses of antipsychotics, but those are only individuals with severe dementia who have psychotic symptoms or agitation. But beyond that, they should not be used at all. But we're still seeing them fairly widely prescribed. And my fear is that we might see history repeat herself unless we get greater transparency in what's happening with the pharmaceutical industry and the medical profession. And maybe everyday people will drive, I think through Twitter and social media, will drive that.
Well, one of the things, you know, where you and I have a slight disagreement is I would not even want them given rarely, because for one thing, once you open the door to that,
yes,
then everybody's clinical judgment comes into play, and I think that they're inherently abusive because they work by lobotomizing. I mean, they calm a patient by producing a chemical lobotomy. So, you know, unable to do it. Yeah.
What yes. I, no,
quickly,
I would agree with you. The medicines work in a very generalized way. These are not specific medications, and they've got to be used very carefully, if at all.
We're going to break quickly. How do people get in touch with you?
Oh, right. The best way to get in touch with me is I've got a website, and it's called, I'll spell it out for you. It means whole being. It's called Whole Oozia. So it's just Whole, H-O-L-E. And then the second word is O-U-S-I-A. And if you type that into Google, you can get hold of me.
I noticed that Googling your name is not an easy way to get you.
No, there's a lot. There's lots of Peter Gordons.
Okie doke. We'll be back in a few minutes to keep up this very, very interesting discussion.
Okay, thank you, Peter.
Hang in there. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin. My guest, Peter Gordon. His website stands for the whole being. It's HOLEOUSIA. But I think Peter is the most self-effacing physician I've ever met because I can't find your name on the website. I can barely find your name anywhere. Hello again.
Hello. Sorry, I'm just going to change phones because this phone has gone a bit funny. One second.
Okie doke.
Is that better?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah, I've got a handheld phone here, and the battery sometimes runs out, so if it bleeps in a bit...
No, you want to be on a hard line with a wire.
Yeah, I know. But my wife's trying to sort it out. But I think we'll be okay, so we'll just keep going.
Yeah, you sound fine. I can hear you good. I was saying, I think you're the most self-facing physician I've ever met, because even when we go to your website... which is H-O-L-E and then O-U-S-I-A, the whole being.
Yes.
Hard to find your name anywhere.
Oh, I know, yes.
Do you have a middle initial?
Sorry?
Do you use a middle initial?
Yes, I do. You can try. My full name's Peter John Gordon, so you can try Peter J. Gordon in inverted commas, and that will get to me. You can also get to me on my NHS email, which is... This is quite straightforward. It's petergordon@nhsnhs.net. So that's quite simple.
Oh, good, 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 good. Okay, okay. Well, where would you like to pick up in this conversation? Do you have a thought about what you've been want to add to it?
I was wondering if people this is my preoccupation, and I'd be interested what other people have in terms of this is not so much age related, but because I did a degree in arts as well as science, I've always been particularly interested in there was a very notable debate that was held in the late 1950s between two academics. One was called C.P. Snow, and the other one was called Leavis. And they got into a real ding-dong debate. And the particular argument was C.P. Snow said that there was a divide between the arts and humanities and science, so a divide between arts and science or between humanities and science. And this is a preoccupation of mine because I find that sometimes when I talk to my colleagues in medicine, they struggle to see where I come from, and they think that I'm perhaps lesser of a scientist or that I'm more of an artist, whereas actually I see myself as Peter and both, and I believe in evidence base, but I also believe that science can struggle with the subjective and the qualitative aspects of people. So I'm very interested in the art side, and increasingly I try to express that in my films, or through poetry, or in a particular abiding interest is in architecture. We're trying to save this house. This may seem a bit peripheral theme, but if you just bear with me, we're trying to save this house outside Edinburgh, which was an Enlightenment house built in 1724 by one of Britain's finest architects, William Adam. And in that house, in the history, is now a ruin. And we're needing $10 million to restore it, and we're trying to get that through a lottery fund. But in its lifetime, that house embodied both science and arts, because it had both brilliant scientists like Clerk Maxwell, who discovered physical energy and electromagnetic energy. He was a relation. And it also had brilliant, not just scientists, but also brilliant artists. And indeed it had a very famous doctor that was who was one of the first people in Britain to look at pathology of brains and talk about brain pathology and dementia. And his name was Dr. Batty Chook. So my interest is in Mavis Bank, and it's got this inscription on it, which I'm just going to read out from you, and it's just on the ruin. Hold on one second. And this inspired me to make a sculpture, and on the ruin it says, "And may God concede that you grow older, either never or late, and that you experience earthly changes late. A and may the put the numerous aids of the road be restored intact. And may it be granted that the older you are, the more beautiful you may shine. And those words really moved me greatly, seeing them in a, on this old ruin that we're trying to save. And I couldn't help but see the parallel with the way that we must look after and respect and value our elders as the rich bounty that we've got, rather than seeing them as a burden, as something that we should, that might be involved in a war against disease, etc. So I thought you'd probably quite like that story.
Yeah,
so what I did as a result of that, I made a sculpture with that inscription, and it's called The Aging Stone. And you can see that, the wee story behind that on my website on Whole Ousia.
Well, what you're doing is so interesting. And one of the things that we don't say enough, too, is to, you know, I'm an older person, and I want to address older persons and say, just keep living fuller and fuller, instead of less and less, and keep growing, developing. I didn't get to ask you when we were talking on the phone a question that I ask all my guests. Did my work in any way figure in your development? You're quite a bit younger than me, quite a bit, several decades. Did you ever read my work along the way?
I haven't as yet, but before the radio broadcast, I looked up, and I will be interested, because what I value anybody who's I value all history, and I think understanding the cultural context in which we live in, you have to have an appreciation of time. One of the greatest poets in Wales is called Dylan Thomas, and he talked about time passes, listen, time passes. And the value that you bring, Peter, in the little bits I've seen so far, and I will certainly be reading more, is that you've passed through different periods of the of mankind's approach to mental suffering. And I think that gives a context and an understanding that one can't just immediately grasp. And it's so, so important that we listen to the likes of yourselves and put this in a way rather than just a market-driven world that will not necessarily get the most important values for any of us, whatever age we are.
Now, do you have a book out yourself yet? I haven't seen that.
I don't know. I've got a few self-published books, but one about Mavis Bank, this house, and one about a Deeside Glen, which where the Royals live. But no, I don't have anything out on medical aspects. I've had a few articles published in the British Medical Journal, and well, not in the British Medical Journal. One in I've had a few articles published, but let's put it that way. But I'm not widely published. No.
I have a question, just from your clinical experience.
Mm-hmm.
When people go through the process of dementia, what do you see happens to personality? Do you see an improvement sometimes, a worsening sometimes? Do you see the personality stay stable through it all? What do you see as the relationship between our identities, our personalities, who we are, and that process of the mechanism breaking down?
Yeah, that's a brilliant question, Peter. It's a really good question and a really important one. And the honest answer, there is differences. But by and large, this is the thing that I would really most like to get across. Even today, I was in our ward, which is a ward, community ward, with individuals with advanced dementia. But I can still go in there, and their humanity still shines. They may not be able to have a rich conversation, but we can talk about things. We can smile. The verbal and visual cues are there. We can talk about music and these sort of things. So so yes, their personality, their identity is still there. They may not be aware, some of them may not be aware of their surroundings or the environment of where they are or what time it is, but their humanity, by and large, is still there. Of course, sometimes that can go in the very advanced stages, but it would be grossly wrong to understand in most individuals who suffer dementia as somehow losing their self. And that's a myth we need to sort of pop. As a generalization, it's wrong. Some people's personalities can improve. Some people's personalities can get a little worse. But by and large, people still stay the person they are. Even, as I was mentioning, the gentleman who was a head teacher that I went walking with, he was just the same man as he was. I'd known him for years and years as his doctor. And as his cognitive abilities declined, he was still the same gentleman that I knew. And he maybe was struggling to identify me in the end, but we were still having the same verbal cues and visual cues and a shared warmth between us. So I think this is another reason where we need to be very careful about the use of medications for what is, in inverted commas, behavioral and psychological problems associated with dementia, because the potential, as you're saying, for abuse, and this has definitely happened, and studies have confirmed this, is that they have been overused. And I think this is why what you're doing, Peter, is very important, to try and get balance back into the medical and caring world about what we do, because part of it's not a malicious thing. It's that there's a lack of understanding. You know, in nursing homes, often the staff are young, poorly trained, not well paid, and they really do care. Most of them care and love their elderly they're looking for. But when they see symptoms, what they see as psychiatric symptoms, they don't understand them, and they think there's a medical basis for it. So then the next thought is, oh, a tablet. That will sort this out straightforward. And so starts a chain of events that potentially can be very unhealthy. And I think this comes back to one particular theme.
Are you there? Peter. I think I may have lost. Peter, we're losing you. You're breaking up. We're talking with Peter Gordon, who is a physician in the NHS, National Health Service, in Great Britain. And I think that we've lost his signal. I'm going to check with my engineer and see, but I think he's gone, unless I've just lost him on my end. I was about to ask him, and I think I have an idea of what he'll tell us. What quite often with the elderly, what I see happening is that the excuse of they're agitated, the excuse that they're angry, the excuse that they can't be controlled becomes the justification for medicating them. And we've developed these concepts about the behavioral problems of the elderly and given them official names. And on that basis, a lot of the drugging continues to go on. And I think that what we have to come to grips with is what Dr. Gordon was just saying, which is that people retain their humanity. And if we realize that being with a person, we can connect with warmth and with caring to them.
Hello, I'm back again.
Yeah, hi, Peter.
I'm very sorry.
No, that's all right. Let me catch you up on what I was saying. I was saying I was going to ask you this question, and then I was answering it, which is
right.
Nowadays, a lot of the excuse for medicating and other abuses, restraint and so on, is mm-hmm. that the elderly, demented patient gets irritable, angry, and difficult to control. And I think that that's ignoring the point you're making, that their humanity is there, and what they still fundamentally need is a sense of security and caring with the people
yes.
around them. Can you address that?
Yeah, I would agree. I think that's absolutely right, and I think this is part of the difficulty in that I don't know about in the States, but the nursing homes really are really rather full. They're understaffed. What we all need as individuals, if we're struggling with any sort of illness, is support, kindness, somebody there, sometimes to be there, you know, holding hands over a long period of time. But in busy nursing homes where they only have a couple of staff, this is extremely difficult and is not really happening. And as we're all living longer and there's more of us growing older, and it seems that it's getting harder to meet that need. And a further thing, I don't know in the States, but my parents live in Edinburgh, And last time we were back, we saw a new nursing home has been built. And everybody talks about good environments, and there is lots of good work about in trying to make dementia-friendly environments. But this nursing home is huge. You know, it's from the outside it looks like a factory, and I'm sure it may be much nicer inside. But surely that's not the homely right environment for it. You know, we need friendly small communities with supportive staff who understand the individual, who understand that to see somebody through their distress might be the best way rather than resorting to medication or other mechanistic ways of trying to help them. So yeah, it's a real problem, and I don't have full answers other than I think we need to properly resource care. We need to educate people to look at the whole person, not to rush in with a medicalized approach unless that is clearly going to bring benefit. I think also just bear with individuals a bit. I think we've maybe put too much pressure on our older generation to say that you must be cognitively able. This doesn't mean to say that I don't want support and care for anybody with dementia. Of course I do. That's my job. But do we need to define all our elderly just by their cognition and just by short-term memory? I think we need to be a little bit careful of that. And I think Stephen Post was entirely right, though he wrote this back 20 years ago, to talk of the potential risks of a hypercognitive society. Certainly amongst my colleagues, the mainstream argument looking for progressive dementia is to look at short-term memory loss and to see if that's progressive. We still have to be quite careful about this. And so when I'm seeing somebody in my clinic, I make sure I talk to them and say, look, yes, I agree. I've tested your memory. I've tested your wider cognition. I found it's not quite right, but it's certainly not dementia. You may be at risk of developing dementia, but the risk is something of the order between 5, at the very most 10% over a year will develop dementia. And at 5 years, no more than 50% ever develop dementia. We know these from big studies. So I say this, look, we need to stay with you, help support you, follow you up. But at this moment in time, don't define yourself by this. I can understand why you worry and that it's difficult, your short-term memory is not perfect, but this may not mean that you're going to develop dementia. Hello?
I just think what you're saying is so important. Again, looking for the humanity of you people, their ability to respond to caring and to warmth and to relationship, and not defining their value by their cognitive abilities. I mean,
yes.
I'm just thinking about my pets, not to compare them to human beings.
Uh-huh.
I have two dogs and two Shetland sheepdogs. The two of them are quite different in their cognitive abilities.
Mm-hmm.
One is far brighter than the other, the younger one.
Yes.
And I love them both.
And
they love
both.
Me.
Yes.
Yeah. And there's a love there between the species. And God, we should be able to do that between ourselves as human beings.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I think one of the highlights of the show for me is your saying not to define people by this disease process to the extent it's a disease, and not to define people by their cognitive ability.
Mm-hmm.
And to continue to come back to what really matters. And for me, you know, the huge part of life that matters is human relationship. I also believe in relationship to God, which is just another kind of meaningful relationship and loving relationship. And to get rid of this idea of the testing and the dissecting out and the petitioning and categorizing people. And I think what you're saying about that is so important.
Did you see when the Olympics were in London, they had the Paralympics, and one of my films was based on the quote for that because it's a well-heard quote, but it was see the ability, not the disability. Now, we recognize that for Paralympians. Shouldn't we be seeing that in everybody? Shouldn't that be the way we see the ability? We look for resilience, our human qualities. It doesn't mean to say that we don't help and care for suffering, but to define ourselves always by that runs a risk, and particularly if you start going into the realms where I think modern, inverted commas, world is going, there is a potential for overdiagnosis, and there's lots of reasons that fuel this, not just the pharmaceutical industry, but they are one of the baddies. The other is a misunderstanding, is a feeling that we I think part of it's really well-intentioned. It's maybe the younger generation feeling they're responsible for the older generation, so wanting to do something. But maybe that wanting to do something doesn't necessarily need to wrap them entirely up in a diagnostic label. It might do, and it might be the appropriate thing, but it might also equally might not be. And this is why the early diagnosis campaigns that I've spent 2 years of my life campaigning to the Scottish Government, principally, about one word, and that one word was the word early, and it was referring to the early diagnosis of dementia. And virtually on my own, probably with one other doctor, but virtually on my own, I managed to get the Scottish Government to reconsider their policy, and indeed the English, the Department of Health in England, they are now talking about a timely diagnosis, and I think that's far better. It's still not perfect, but it's far better. It's looking at a very complicated issue and not simplifying and saying you have an easy divide between somebody who's got memory problems and somebody who's got dementia. And then this invites the further discussion about what you were saying, Peter, and what we both agree in, is that diagnosis is important, but it shouldn't be. It has become, in policy terms, it's become the holy grail, and there is definite risks with that. But you'll get people arguing the other way. I constantly get people arguing the other way, saying, well, you mustn't miss a diagnosis. We must get in there early because you can help people in a different way. No, we must start with the person. What do they want? We shouldn't decide on behalf of anybody else. I think we must start with the person. And one of my obsessions is about pathways and protocols and guidelines, which I do believe have a place. But there is a risk with them is that they start with a disease rather than the person. And that a small thing like that can have significant consequences. So I tend to be a bit preoccupied and go on and on about these things, as my nursing team know, but I think I do believe they're very important.
I think everything you're saying is extremely important. One of the things that occurs to me, which I never quite put together before in my own mind, it was fairly obvious maybe, is the way we diagnose behavior in children and say it's the child's fault and we have to drug it. We call kids with ADHD or oppositional defiance disorder. So we diagnose a behavior without looking at the child and what the child needs. And we're doing the same thing with the elderly and with people who have signs of dementia. We're diagnosing their behaviors and treating them rather than looking at the person. Does that make sense? Is that a real analogy?
That's a very good observation, and I would agree fully with that. And some of my best friends in the internet world are people who are child and family psychiatrists, and they've got this insight. They can see that we've grossly medicalized behavior in children and given it an artificial construct without understanding the context or supporting the child. And gosh, I think both age groups have been particularly vulnerable, actually. They are young. And in my world, I also believe that our elderly are vulnerable, despite the policies that are well intentioned. I don't believe that governments or charities are doing policies out of any bad intention. I just think sometimes what's missing in them is evidence, because I still believe in evidence, but also ethics. Ethics seems to be the last thing that's often considered, and what ethics always reminds you is that when it comes to human beings and our psychology and our behavior, don't simplify it. If you simplify it at your peril, because then you will misunderstand the person. You will misunderstand that person who lives in a life, who lives in a sea of interactions with other people, who, yes, may have a brain disease, but it may not be as simple as that. And so you need to take everything together. And that's why as soon as you starting with an artificial place like a pathway or a guideline, that, and let's be honest, there's increasing talk about guidelines being partly in the embrace of the pharmaceutical industry, then you get into the realms of being over-medicalized, the potential for counter-interactions with lots of medications. And once you start a medication, as my wife's a GP, we both agree it's much easier to start a medication than it is to stop one. And so a lot of the elders that I see in my day-to-day practice come on, I don't know if this is the same in America, but umpteen different medications. Now, I'm not just talking about psychotropics, but I'm talking about statins and blood pressure medications. And all of these may be important, but you've got to wonder, if each one's regulated by a separate guideline and you end up on 10 different medications from 10 different guidelines. Where's the holism in that? I don't think there is. So I think that's another big issue for our elders, is the potential to become... medicine may help, but there's also potential to end up in more medicines than might be good for you.
Yeah, I think the problem is as big in North America as in Great Britain, if not worse in the U.S. What about economics? You haven't mentioned that. What about the economics of the health service? We're struggling with that now as we move in your direction. And how is that... I mean, it tends to make us treat the elderly as expensive burdens, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. I don't know if you find it. I get very, too often I see some very influential people talking about the word burden, but you could apply the word burden you've got to be very careful of using that word. And unfortunately, it's become associated with growing older. And it has all sorts of negative connotations. There is, of course, and everybody's aware that in the Western world, demographics are changing and people are living longer. But as well as that discussion, we've got to have the discussion about living longer and living better. It's the well-being. And
Peter,
I do think that discussion is beginning to happen.
We're going to break, coming to a conclusion. My guest, my marvelous guest, Dr. Peter Gordon, from Scotland and from the National Health Service. His website, H-O-L-E, Whole, OSEA, O-U-S-I-A, a specialist in working with older folks and mostly just a human being, a caring human being, a really good doc. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you. Peter J. Gordon.